You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Introducing Anthroposophical Medicine. This is Lecture 16, given in Dornach on April 5th, 1920. You will see that the answers to the questions you so kindly gave me now begin to appear in the lectures. It was simply a matter of creating the foundation for a rational response. Today, I would like to link up with the last topic we talked about yesterday, when I was able to draw your attention to the significance of spleen functions in the human organism. These functions are the regulators of our subconscious soul life and must be addressed as such. We misunderstand the entire nature of the human being if we believe the spleen to be an organ of secondary importance. Admittedly, it is not difficult for this error or misunderstanding to arise, because the spleen is such a highly spirit-pervaded organ that its functions are very easily taken over by only the etheric spleen, and other organs can also be called upon to step in and take over its functions. You will see, however, that the effect of the spleen becomes more curious the more it is lifted up out of the subconscious into the consciousness. At this point, we come to a certain method of healing that has attracted interest recently, which, strangely enough, takes the effect of the spleen as a starting point, spleen massage. You will be convinced that gently massaging the area of the spleen initially has a balancing effect on human instinctual activity. When people receive gentle massages to the area of the spleen, they develop better instincts in some respects. For example, it becomes easier for them to discover what foods suit them, and generally what is useful or not useful to their bodies. But there are immediate limits to massaging this area. As soon as the effect grows too strong, it becomes capable of completely undermining instinctual activity once again. A curious pause ensues here at the null point. This massage must not be taken too far. What is this actually related to? Gently massaging the spleen, the area of the spleen, that is, drives something into that area that is otherwise not there. In a certain way, the consciousness of the person being massaged is projected in that direction. A great deal depends on this shift and flow of consciousness. The limits of our language sometimes makes it difficult to express adequately such subtle workings in the human organism. But strange as it may sound, there is a strong interaction between the unconscious activity of reason and common sense, which is mediated by the spleen, or rather by the spleen's functions, and the human organism's conscious functions. And what are these conscious functions? All physical processes in the organism that are accompanied by higher conscious processes, and especially by ideational processes, have toxic effects. This must not be overlooked. The human organism is constantly poisoning itself through its ideational activity and is continually counteracting these toxic conditions with unconscious states of will. The center of unconscious states of will is located in the spleen. If we pervade the spleen with consciousness, influencing it through massage, we work against the highly toxic effect that emanates from our higher consciousness. Spleen massage, however, does not always have to be external massage. It can also be internal massage. You may argue that this should not be called massage, but the important point is that we understand each other. Spleen massage can also be implemented like this. If we see that a person has a strong inner organic activity that stems from toxic conditions, we can influence the spleen's abnormal state of consciousness by telling that person to eat as little as possible at meal times, and to eat more frequently, dividing up the meals so there is less time between them. Dividing up the activity of eating massages the spleen internally and has a profound effect on its activity. Of course, there is a certain catch to this, just as there is always a catch to such processes. You see, in our hurried times, people, or at least many people, are always involved in external stressful activity that has an extremely strong influence on spleen function. People do not do as certain animals do, which stay healthy by lying down after eating and refusing to allow their digestion to be disturbed by outer activity. These animals spare the functioning of their spleen. People who are engaged in outer, nervous, hurried activity do not do this. As a result, spleen activity is gradually becoming highly abnormal among all of civilized humanity, and it is becoming especially important to relieve the functions of the spleen by using the methods that I have just spoken about. Being attentive to subtle forms of massage, such as internal and external spleen massage, points very neatly to the connections between the human organs that are the vehicles of the unconscious and those that are the vehicles of consciousness. This leads us to discover the importance of massage, or at least makes it easier for us to understand its entire significance. Massage has a certain importance, and under some circumstances, it can also have a strong healing effect, although its primary effect is on the regulation of rhythmical activity in the human being. But if we want the massage to be successful, we must know the human organism well. For guidance on this path, consider the tremendous difference between the arms and the legs in the human organization, not in the animal, but in the human being. In human arms, which are relieved of the burden of gravity and move freely, the astral body is much more loosely bound to the physical body than it is in the feet. In human feet, the astral body is very closely bound to the physical. We might say that in the arms, the astral body works more through the skin, from the outside in. It envelops the arms and hands and works from the outside inward. In a sense, it has a swaddling effect. In the legs and feet, the will works through the astral body in a way that is very strongly centrifugal, radiating from the inside out. This is the reason for the considerable difference between arms and legs. Consequently, if we massage a person's legs and feet, we are doing something fundamentally different from massaging the person's arms and hands. When we massage someone's arms, it draws the astral body in from outside. This makes the arms much more into instruments of the will than normal, which has the effect of regulating the internal metabolic exchange between the intestines and the blood vessels. In this way, we work more on blood formation when we massage the arms and hands. In contrast, if we massage the feet and legs, the physical aspect is transformed into an ideational one to a greater extent. This has a regulating effect on the metabolic processes of elimination and excretion. In this extension of the effects of massage, moving in one instance from the arms toward the inner anabolic realm of metabolism, and in the other instance toward the catabolic realm, we see what a complicated creature the human organism really is. If you investigate these issues rationally, you will discover that every part of the body has a specific connection to other body parts. Understanding this inner interaction in the appropriate way is the basis of effective massage. Massaging the abdomen can always have beneficial effects, even with regard to respiration. It is especially interesting to note that abdominal massage has a particularly good influence on respiratory activity. When we massage directly below the area of the heart, respiration is influenced more strongly. Whereas, if we move further down, it influences the organs in the throat. The action is reversed when we massage the torso. As we move farther, it has a greater effect on the upper organs. For example, we can enhance an arm massage by also massaging the uppermost part of the torso. I might say these things illustrate the connection between individual members of the human organism. In particular, we can see that this interaction between the upper and lower parts of the human being, or in general, between related parts that are sometimes quite far apart, appears in conditions such as migraine. In truth, migraine is nothing but the shifting of digestive activities, which should actually have their seat in the rest of the organism, into the head. This is why anything that makes too many demands on the rest of the organism, such as menstrual periods, for example, also affects migraines. We can say that when misplaced digestive activity takes place in the head, the cranial nerves are burdened with something they are normally freed from. The very fact that only highly regulated digestive activity in the form of absorption takes place in the head frees up the cranial nerves to become sensory nerves. When the above-mentioned unregulated activity takes place in the head, they lose this quality and become inwardly sensitive and receptive to things that the internal parts of the organism should not be able to sense. This is the basis for the pain of migraine and all similar conditions. It is quite understandable how someone must feel when suddenly forced to perceive the interior of the head instead of the outer world. If we understand this condition properly, however, we will be able to suggest only that the best cure for migraine is sleeping it off in peace, or something like that. Everything that people take for it, or which they are sometimes forced to take, has harmful effects. By taking the usual allopathic medications, you anesthetize the neural apparatus that has been sensitized, meaning that you impair its activity. Let us say that someone suffers a migraine attack shortly before having to go on stage, and chooses to put up with a certain amount of damage rather than not being able to perform. In this case, it is especially easy to observe the anesthetization of something that should not be anesthetized. Such instances demonstrate that the human organism is extremely subtle, and that one is often forced to sin against its demands, simply as a consequence of being socially entangled in life. This is self-evident and should not be disregarded. Sometimes we may simply have to accept the damage that results from a person's situation in life and attempt to cure its inevitable consequences later. The great subtlety of human bodily organization also becomes evident if we investigate color and light therapy in the right way. Therapy of this sort should certainly be taken into account to a greater extent in the future than has been the case in the past. We also need to explore the difference between the effect of color, which appeals entirely to the upper part of the human being, and the effect of light, which is more objective in scope and appeals to the whole human being. A direct effect on an organ can be achieved by bringing someone into a room where objective color and light shine upon the entire person, or where a specific body part is exposed to the purely objective effect of color or light. This is something that definitely affects the person from outside. If, however, the exposure is brought about in a way that engages the impression of color or the presence of the color, which is otherwise engaged only by consciousness, the effect is different. That is, if instead of allowing colored light to shine on a person, I bring that person into a room that is totally decorated in a certain color, the effect is different and pervades all the organs leading up to the organs of consciousness. Subjective color therapy of this sort invariably affects the eye, capital, while objective color therapy works on the physical system, through which it only indirectly affects the eye. Please do not say that because blind people are unable to receive visual impressions, it is irrelevant to bring them into a room decorated in a certain color, and that the inevitable result will be the total absence of any effect on them. This is not the case. In this instance, certain effects that emanate from perceptible things, but lie below the level of perceptibility, emerge very strongly. Even if the people I bring into a room painted red or blue are blind, the color still makes a difference to them. It makes a significant difference. And it must be said that the effect of bringing blind people into a blue-walled room is to shift the entire organization, their entire functioning, away from the head and toward the rest of the organism. If I bring them into a red-walled room, their functioning shifts away from the rest of the organism and toward the head. From this discussion, you can see that the rhythm induced by allowing one color to alternate with another must be the essential factor when the surroundings are objectively suffused with color. Whether the room we bring people into is blue or red is less important than whether we bring them into a blue room after first experiencing a red one, or vice versa. This is of crucial importance. If I see a general need to bring about improvement in the rest of a person's system by strongly stimulating that person's head functions, I move that person from a blue room into a red one. If I want to improve someone's head function by way of the rest of the organism, I move that person from a red room into a blue one. I believe that such matters will become very important in the not-too-distant future, and that color therapy, as opposed to light therapy, will have an important role to play. It is important to allow a role in any future therapy for the interplay between the conscious and the unconscious. This will help us to develop healthy judgment concerning the peculiar way that substances work on the human being through baths, for example. It makes a great deal of difference whether the impression made by external applications is cold or warm. It must be understood that a cold impression, a cooling effect of a compress or bath, indicates that the substance itself is the active therapeutic principle. It is the effect of the particular therapeutic substance that is important in this instance. It is not the substance itself that is important, however. If the effect of an application, such as a compress, is warming rather than cooling, the substance used is almost irrelevant in this case, since it is the warming effect that must be considered. The origin of the warming effect is irrelevant to the effect itself. In the case of cold compresses, then, we must always pay attention to how we can tincture the fluid or water being used with a substance. We can elicit the effectiveness of these substances when we are able to make them work in cold water, that is, if they are soluble at low temperatures. In contrast, unless we are using etheric substances or highly aromatic substances, which constitute a somewhat different case, because their effects are also present at high temperatures, we cannot produce any significant direct effect from solid substances that do not dissolve easily. We will not be able to induce real healing effects with warm compresses or baths. On the other hand, if substances similar in nature to sulfur or phosphorus, such as sulfur itself, accompany a warm bath, they will be especially able to develop their corresponding therapeutic effects. The important point here is the subtle observation of relationships, such as those I have just presented. At this point, I would like to say that you will find it very useful to establish an archetypal phenomenon of some sort. It is interesting to note that this method played a great role when medical knowledge, and so on, were still cultivated on the basis of the mysteries to a greater extent. In those times, issues were stated in terms of archetypal phenomena, rather than theoretically. For example, one such statement was, "By taking honey or wine internally, you strengthen the forces of cosmic origin that work in you." We might also say that this strengthens the forces of the I, capital, which would be the same thing. I think such a statement makes it very easy to gain an overview of the subject. Also, quote, "By rubbing an oily substance into your body, you weaken the harmful effects of the earthly forces within you," close quote. That is, of the forces that counteract the effect of the I in the organism. And, quote, "By finding the balance between sweet strengthening from the inside and oily weakening from the outside, you will live long," close quote. The physicians of antiquity also said, quote, "Rub yourself with oil to remove the damaging influences of the earth, and if you are able to do so, if your organization is not too weak, strengthen the forces of the eye with honey or wine. Thus, you strengthen the forces that lead to old age." Close quote. Any statement such as this was meant to express the archetypal phenomenon of the matter. It was intended to point people in the right direction, through facts rather than through theorems or dogma. We must make our way back to this approach, because it is much easier to get your bearings among all the many substances of the outer world if you can refer back to archetypal phenomena rather than to abstract, so-called natural laws, which leave you in the lurch whenever you want to tackle anything concrete. I would like to present you with a few of these archetypal phenomena that are easy to state. Quote, "By putting your feet in water, you evoke abdominal forces that promote the formation of blood," close quote. Here you have an archetypal phenomenon that points you strongly in the right direction. Quote, "By washing your head, you evoke abdominal forces that regulate elimination," close quote. These archetypal phenomena are very informative because they encompass the lawfulness and reality of the issues. The human being is present in statements such as these because, of course, they would make no sense if I were not thinking about the human being. The fact that I am thinking about the human being is very important in all these areas. Once again, these things point to a more spatial interaction of forces in the human organism. A temporal interaction is also present, however, and we encounter it clearly when we observe people who have been mishandled in their childhood or early adolescence to such an extent that for the rest of their lives they can cultivate only things that should actually be cultivated in adulthood, rather than things that should be cultivated in adolescence and childhood. Let me express myself more clearly. During adolescence, human beings develop certain forces that shape the organism during that same period. Not everything that takes shape during adolescence, however, is immediately put to the right use. Shaping the organism during adolescence also serves to store up something that becomes effective only during adulthood. I might say that certain organs that are built up during childhood should not be used then and there. Since in adulthood, however, it is no longer possible to build them up, they are kept in reserve for later use. For example, people should be educated through imitation up to the second dentition, after which authority should play a big part in their education. If this is not taken into account, organs that should remain in reserve for adulthood may be called upon prematurely. With modern materialistic ways of thinking, people may object and say that how we use imitation or authority could not possibly be so important. In fact, however, it is tremendously important, because the effect carries over into the organism. For example, it is very important to allow children to grow into liking a particular food by imitating the sympathy their parents or teachers have for that food. That is, you bring the imitative principle into connection with developing an appetite for a particular food. An extension of the imitative urge is then present in the organism. Later, the same is true of authority. To put it briefly, if organs, these are very delicate structures, of course, that are meant to be held in reserve for adulthood, are called up during childhood, the terrible illness that we call schizophrenia appears. Since this is the real basis of schizophrenia, appropriate education is an excellent preventive. At the moment, what we are attempting in the Waldorf school can be implemented only after the age of 6 or 7, and cannot yet be extended to early childhood education. But, as I described in my booklet titled The Education of the Child, schizophrenia will disappear if it becomes possible some day to place education as a whole in the service of the knowledge that comes from spiritual science. Shaping education in this way prevents people from calling on their adult organs prematurely. This is something that must be said with regard to appropriate education. The opposite also exists in life. It involves saving organ effects for later that should unfold only during adolescence. Throughout life, there are demands placed on organs that exist primarily for the benefit of childhood and adolescence. But the consequences of such demands are damaging unless they gradually diminish. In this area, a great variety of causes permit such practices as psychoanalysis to intervene in human thinking as a whole in a confusing way. It is, in fact, true that the most damage is caused not by major errors, which are soon revealed as such, but by those that contain kernels of truth, since they may be taken to extremes and misused. What is the phenomenon behind the rise of a view such as that of psychoanalysis? It is this: because of today's lifestyle, which is frequently unnatural and fails to adapt human beings sufficiently to the outer environment, much of what impresses people during childhood remains unprocessed. Such impressions simply remain a part of our psychological makeup, without being appropriately incorporated into the organism as well. The slightest effect on the psychological level extends, or should extend, also into the organism. But a child today receives many impressions that are highly abnormal, so that they must remain psychological impressions and not become immediately transformed into organic impressions. they continue to work as psychological impressions. Instead of participating in a person's entire development, they remain as isolated soul impulses. If they were to participate in bodily development as a whole, they would not remain isolated soul impulses, and would not place demands later in life on the organs that exist only for the sake of adulthood, and are no longer present to make use of adolescent impressions. Thus, an inappropriate situation arises. The individual as a whole is forced to permit isolated soul impulses to act on organs no longer suited to this purpose. The symptoms that then emerge can be diagnosed by means of a properly applied psychoanalytic method. By questioning the patient, it is possible to discover certain things that are still present in his or her soul life, impressions that simply have not been processed, and have devastating effects on organs that have become too old to do this processing. The important point here, however, is that this route leads only to diagnosis, but never to therapy. If we use psychotherapy simply as a diagnostic method, we are doing something that is somehow justified if conducted tactfully. Many letters that have been written to me, however, claim that psychoanalysts use their receptionists like spies to unearth all kinds of issues on which they then question their patients. This happens so frequently that all of psychoanalysis has been tainted by this nonsense. But if we disregard these unfortunate incidents, and it really all depends on the moral stance of the people involved, we can say that from the perspective of diagnosis, there is some truth in psychoanalysis, but it is never possible to be therapeutically effective by taking the psychoanalytic route. Once again, this is related to a phenomenon of our times. The tragedy of materialism is that it leads us away from actually recognizing matter, prevents us from acknowledging matter. Materialism is less damaging to the recognition of the spirit itself than to the recognition of the spiritual aspect of matter. Preventing the view that spiritual effects are omnipresent in connection with matter, preventing us from looking for spiritual effects in matter, blocks many considerations that should not be blocked for the sake of a healthy view of human life. If I am a materialist, I cannot possibly ascribe all the properties we have discussed here to matter. Materialism considers it sheer nonsense to ascribe these properties to matter, even though they are properties it does indeed possess. This means that we move away from the possibility of acknowledging matter for what it is. We no longer speak of phosphorus-like or salt-like phenomena and so forth, because all this is seen as nonsense. We move away from both the possibility of acknowledging the spirit in matter and the possibility of studying formative effects properly. Above all, we move away from the insight that each human organ has the dual task of being oriented toward consciousness and toward its own solely vegetative process. This view has been lost in one area in particular that we will now discuss, namely how we consider the teeth. From the materialistic perspective, teeth are seen as mere chewing instruments, more or less, but that is not all they are. Their dual nature becomes evident from the very fact that while a merely chemical investigation suggests that they are related to the skeletal system, from a phylogenetic perspective, they actually develop out of the skin system. The teeth, in particular, have a dual nature, but their second nature is extremely well concealed. If you compare animal teeth to human teeth, you will see that what I said in the very first lecture about the element of weight, which the entire ape skeleton presents, is especially strongly expressed in the structure of an animal's jaw and teeth. In a certain way, we see the effects of uprightness even in the human mouth. This is related to the fact that teeth are not merely chewing implements, but also very important suction devices. On the one hand, they have an outer mechanical effect, but on the other hand, they also have an inherent inner suction effect that is very delicate and spiritualized. At this point, we are forced to ask what the teeth actually draw in. For as long as they can, they draw in fluorine. They are suction devices for drawing in fluorine. We human beings need very small quantities of fluorine in our bodies. And at this point, I'm going to say something that may shock you. If we do not have it, we become too intelligent. We become so intelligent, it almost destroys us. Fluorine's effects tone us down to the appropriate level of stupidity that we need in order to be human. We need fluorine in small quantities to constantly counteract the process of becoming too intelligent. Early dental decay, which is a lessening of the effects of fluorine, points to excessive demands that are being made on the teeth's ability to draw in fluorine. It points out that something is making the person in question defend him or herself against stupidity. We will speak about these issues later, although there is not much time left. The person in question is destroying his or her teeth so that the effect of fluorine does not cause excessive stupidity. Just think about this extraordinarily subtle connection. Our teeth decay so that we don't become too stupid. This shows you the intimate connection between effects that are useful to human beings and the damaging effects that are the opposite pole of the pendulum swing. Under certain circumstances, we need the effects of fluorine so that we do not become too intelligent. We can also do ourselves damage, however, by making these effects too strong, in which case we destroy our teeth through the activity of our organs. These are issues I ask you to ponder carefully, because they are related to extremely significant processes in the human organism. The end of Lecture 16.